welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Senses of Security. By someone, oh, you've got a false sense of security about that person or something. Or I don't know, I'm not sure people ever use the phrase true sense of security. But this week we're talking about having a sense of security, a bit like a sixth sense where, you know, sometimes you might feel secure in a situation where you probably shouldn't, or you feel a bit insecure about a situation but you probably should, or you know, any kind of iteration or combination of feeling a certain way and that being either discordant or matching the circumstances that you're in. The reason we're doing that is because we're chatting this week about a new release. It's November, directed by Cedric Jimenez, which hits Australian cinemas on the 11th of May, 2023. I had the chance to see that one this week and really enjoyed it. And I was really interested in how it depicted, I suppose, the surveillance state in a way that kind of makes you as a viewer feel kind of happy that it exists, I suppose you could say, in a very blunt sense. And I wanted to talk about, you know, it's a really interesting topic to me about how we have this really interesting relationship with the state and feeling, wanting to feel secure, but at the same time wanting to maintain freedoms. And I think that's very relevant to what we've been talking about this last couple of weeks. I suppose there's something in the air, isn't there? Last week when we were talking about the surveillance state or simulations and totalitarian control and technology and the way it sort of envelops us and when we live in the 21st century. And it's certainly something we've talked about a lot on this show. Lots of episodes we've been talking about state security and that sort of thing. So I guess it's kind of a mashup this week of the last couple of weeks that we've been talking about, and also the episode we did on false prophets, which is something we go back to and talk about. We talk about the film The Night of the Hunter, I feel like, every third or fourth week on this show. We did La Ricotta, the Pasolini short film Night of the Hunter by Charles Laughton, and Martha Marcy May Marlene that week. So if you're interested in some of the topics we'll talk about this week, I suggest you go back and check out those episodes. But we're kind of talking about instances which people kind of give us perhaps a false sense of security, or at least that's what we talked about when we did that episode on false prophets. This week we're kind of expanding it out a bit. We're kind of fleshing out a little bit more and maybe talking a little bit talking more about situations, not just where someone claims to be a leader, someone that claims that, you know, you can trust, but also looking at the sort of thing where I guess we're firstly going to look at, you know, why we yearn for a sense of security and leaders that claim to offer us security and why we allow ourselves to become prone to exploitation. But we're also going to expand out and talk about instances in which maybe like even victimhood can be a means of exploitation, and pretty much really get into the nitty-gritty of how human beings can be so easily exploited, even when we have all the facts, even when we know everything in front of us. So let's get started, though, because it's three pretty big films. The first one is going to be November, the new release by Cedric Jimenez, which comes out on the 11th of May this year in Australia. We're then going to move on to Alfonso Cuarón's film from 2006, Children of Men. And then we're going to finish off with Alex Garland's Ex Machina, or Ex Machina, from 2014. But let's get things started now with November, directed by Cedric Jimenez. So as I kind of hinted at a few minutes ago, this one follows the workings of, well, I didn't actually go into the detail about what it's about specifically, but it goes into the workings of the French anti-terrorism services during the 5 days that followed the attacks in Paris on the 13th of November, 2015. So it's a pretty intense watch, and, you know, these are pretty recent attacks, and it's pretty much based on a true story, and so it's a pretty heavy watch. But this week we're going to look at it sort of through the lens of, as I mentioned a second ago, the human yearning for security. So this anti-terrorism service, which is run by Jean Dujardin, he's the main character, who people would know from things like The Artist and things like that. It's a very elaborate organization that I guess you could say is characterized by surveillance, ultra coordination, ultra collaboration, a kind of relentless commitment. I should say it's a really good choice in this film to have to talk about the actual day-to-day lives of the workers themselves. There's lots of little choices about, you know, not stopping to go home, be with their families, not stopping to. So it's almost like an homage, or it sort of honors the people that kind of worked around the clock during these 5 days. It's a big part of the film, the actual logistics of the 5 days themselves. But then all that sort of culminates to be this sort of relentless commitment to protecting the French people, kind of working round the clock to make sure the French people are there. So we do have this concept of being enveloped by the surveillance state in this film. They're always watching, they're always at their desks, they're always looking out for us in a way. It almost goes to the point of absurdity in a weird kind of way. There's actually a lot of dialogue in the film where the characters totally dispose of kind of any value for personal privacy, almost to the point that they kind of make jokes. There's a scene, I can't remember the specific line, but there's a scene where sort of one of the younger workers is trying to, you know, has been tasked with tracking a certain person down, one of the people that they're going after. And I think it's Jean Dujardin's character is like, I want you to, you know, if they touch a Coke glass, I want you to get it out of the garbage. You know, if they look into a single mobile phone screen, I want you to get the they completely dispose of any sense of personal privacy. And you would think that maybe as an audience member, you look at that and you think, you know, as a result, oh man, I'm so cynical of the modern surveillance state. It's terrible how much control they have over us. But, and look, maybe it's just me, but I had a truly insightful experience watching this film. I'm not sure it's actually the fundamental intention of the film. I do think the intention of the film is more to sort of pay homage to sort of the heroic feats of these people that did all this stuff. But just on another level, if we're going to be a little bit more postmodern about it, I suppose, that I had a truly insightful experience watching this film where I noticed how much I wanted them to get these damn terrorists. Like, I was totally invested in them getting these rat bags, and I felt like I was totally on the side of the police, and I considered them very brave, and I considered all these anti-terrorism people. As I was walking out the cinema, I was thinking about them looking after us in a way, and I was like, and I actually weirdly at the same time, this is like art imitating life. I got this weird text from the New South Wales Police at the time, saying, look out for this guy at Central Station. He was last, I don't know what it was, I think he was just a missing guy. But I had this moment of like, that's kind of crazy that came just after watching this film. But I actually did feel this kind of sense of security. Like, if anyone is trying to do bad things around the city of Sydney, for example, which people have done in recent years, I was kind of very glad and admirable of the fact that had been done. There's a particular scene actually in the film that I, because I don't want to give too much away because, you know, it hasn't come out yet, but there was a particular scene where Jean Dujardin's character is taunting one of the suspects, almost in like a Dark Knight-y kind of Guantanamo Bay interrogation scene. And I think in a lot of other films, we start to go, oh, you know, don't hit him, don't torture. I really felt my blood boiling when the terrorist suspect started taunting him. And I think if you are someone that is sort of cynical of the surveillance state, this film I think is worth seeing just to see how much you can be tested, or how much you can test those loyalties, because I think it really does put you right in the shoes of someone that does start patting people on the back for, you know, looking over our shoulders and things like that. But obviously, right? Obviously, it does sort of follow that knowing how scared people like me can get and how thirsty for security that we can be, that protection, particularly state protection, can go too far. And so what's a film that actually, I think it's important that we go to a film now that sort of talks about the surveillance state going too far. But before we do that, just to remind you are listening to 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the remainder of this half-hour slot. Be sure to jump onto our website for more quality radio program, or stay tuned for that as well. But jump onto our website to subscribe and consider sponsoring the show. All of that would be very much, we're very grateful for that, and we will be watching you if you choose to do that. But moving on now to our second film for today, Children of Men, directed by Alfonso Cuarón. And if you haven't seen this one, it's like a dystopian film. I think it's in the Criterion Collection. It's a very highly revered film, but it's also a science fiction-y film. So the artsy people love it. The mainstreamers like it too. But it's like a dystopian thriller, I suppose, starring Clive Owen. I've got Julianne Moore in there. And it's a world where women have stopped being able to have children. And you're basically seeing the end of human civilization. And the lens through which we're going to look at it, we're going to look at it through the lens where we're talking about, as I said before, where protection of the state or state protection goes too far. Specifically talking about how society can become dystopian in the name of safety. Now, we're not going to go straight into the idea of the wolf in sheep's clothing straight away, the false prophet idea, which we are going to unpack later in the show. This is sort of an example of a situation where the state isn't exactly pretending to be the friend of the people, right? It kind of accepts the brashness of governance, but demands that the citizens kind of put up with it anyway in the name of safety. And there's a lot of fear-mongering about illegal immigrants mostly in this film, because all these other cities and countries in the world have failed and the UK is the only one left. There's a lot of V for Vendetta-ness in this film. If you like V for Vendetta, you'll like this film. I guess the government in this film is kind of like, even if you don't like the vibe, right? Even if you don't like us carrying around guns and things like that, at least you can be sure that you're safe and secure. Because we've got the guns, we've got the helmets, and even though there's graffiti everywhere and people screaming, at least you know that the state is protecting you. And you can kind of see how someone might be like, yeah, you can see this in the real world, people kind of do that a little bit. They go like, oh, I don't really like him, or I don't like that politician, or whatever, but I am glad they kind of keep us safe. Like, that is a real thing that can kind of spiral out of control in the real world. But why is this undesirable, right? And I think it's a bit of a given, but let's unpack it. Well, for starters, it's very Orwellian, right? It's very 1984, and we see that in the film, the reporting on each other, seeing, there's billboards about, suspecting people. You know, if you see someone housing an illegal immigrant, there's all these like things in the train and stuff and things like that, and we've talked about that a lot recently, the idea of if you want to progress society, or if you have what you would call an ideal or utopian, it ends up being dystopian, but a utopian idea of society, it's going to come at a great cost. If you want to progress society further, it's almost like an inverse thing. The more that you want to progress, the more radically you want to progress society, the more control you're going to need to seize from the individual. It's kind of like a running theme in a lot of these films. Not to be too political, take it as you will. But also there's examples of, people being mandated to have their bodies governed to the extreme. There's mandatory fertility tests, obviously. There's like this promotion of suicide, like there's this weird suicide company that like the government's okay with. And there's literal caging of very desperate people as well. So they may be illegal under the law, but like when you look at it like that, that seems wrong. As we often feel when we see people screaming in cages, no matter sort of what they have done or where they've come from in the modern world. And I think just on a very basic level as well, we see a lot of just brutal inhumanity in this film that just makes you as a viewer very sad. Like just on an instinctive level, we don't like the look of what we see, not just the cages, but like how inhumane a lot of the stuff is. It's very cold. A lot of the killings aren't sexy. It actually makes you, this is the kind of film I was like, if I watched this film when I was a kid, it would have given me nightmares to see sort of how cold yet how believable a lot of these baddies in this film are. But there's a whole other thing on top of all that. Yes, it's Orwellian. Yes, it's suffocating on the individual. But the means still fail to justify the ends, right? This is all in the name of safety. The whole point is to protect and serve here. But it doesn't work. And what's really powerful about this film is that it's completely possible that we're seeing a democracy in action, or just a regular Joe Blow politician who had good intentions to begin with but got it all wrong. It's a bit like when we talked about Wag the Dog. They never actually showed the president. We don't actually see the politicians here. And I think that's really important, because it does mean this isn't the result of a terrible dictator. It's the result of a system. It's the result of circumstance. It's something that's not really to do with an individual person, but rather the collective in general. And what's really, tragically ironic, is that the only hope, and that's the whole thing that anchors the film, i.e. the film is kind of about how centralized societies or extremely centralized societies can't fulfill their core obligations of protecting and allowing the human race to survive. The whole film turns on Clive Owen trying to save this little baby that his ex-wife through some, I don't want to go into it, but basically he meets up with a girl who has a baby, and they're trying to leave Britain in order to get them to this sanctuary that's off the coast. And the irony is that the whole point of this ultra-surveillance state is to keep the people governed, but their only hope, this little baby, is trying to get out. And the only obstacles in its place are those placed by the system itself, the system that claims to be you know, upholding safety and security. But also, we also just see a general lack of security as a result of all this, specifically a lack of trust between individuals, which makes sense given that there's such a promotion of cynicism and suspicion against each other. So the whole idea, you know, the whole thing of reporting on each other and being cynical, the outcome of that is that no one trusts each other. So then people don't, you know, they don't work together. There's no interconnectedness. There's no communal safety if everyone's constantly being told that they should suspect everybody. And that the idea of trust and honesty and not, and this is where we get into the sort of false prophets territory. It's a running motif in this film. Every character, down to the, you know, down to the people that have the badges on and those that don't, the ones with dreadlocks, blah, blah, blah. No one is safe in this film. And it's a really cleverly done film. Like at the start, you kind of get this, I almost was like disappointed by like, oh, here we go again. The hippies are the ones that we trust and the policemen are the ones we don't trust. And not to say that it isn't the case a lot of the time. I'm just saying that like a film should, you know, rebel and they should, you know, make us think of things that we don't otherwise, you know, currently think of on our own and da 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 da. But through this film, you constantly find that every time you trust someone, they turn on you and vice versa. And there's a really important plot point in this film that the girl, the mother of the little girl is told by Julianne Moore, who's Clive Owen's ex-wife, and you know there's some irony in that that they're exes. But he's like, she's like, no matter what, only trust Theo. And you, as the film progresses, you see why that is. But even the police, right? Even some of the police characters, it's kind of like a yes no yes no yes no thing. Like sometimes they actually are trustworthy in this film, but then they stop being trustworthy. And there's other scenes where you know they're totally cooked. The protagonists are totally cooked, and it's the police that actually like save them weirdly. And similarly as well, as I mentioned before, I think the film is made better by the fact that a lot of the hippie sort of activist-y characters who are kind of stereotypically good and you know, I don't use the word woke, but you know what I mean, they're actually bad guys as well in different parts of the film. So I think when watching a film like this, we certainly get a sense that claims to protection, or at least on a very basic level, claims to benevolence, claims to being trustworthy on all levels, on both the state level and the individual level, are not fail-safe, right? We can't really trust someone just because they say or claim to be trustworthy, or they put a hell of a lot of time and resources into being supposedly trustworthy. But can we sort of pull this out further? Can we talk about some of the sort of large-scale implications of this sort of in the current world and with in light of current problems that we're currently facing, rather than, you know, in the future, in some kind of dystopian future? Well, let's finish off now with Ex Machina, directed by Alex Garland from 2014. And this film kind of turns on the Turing test, which I think is a perfect metaphor. If we're doing a week on deceit and deception and not being trustworthy and that sort of thing, the Turing test, if you're not sure what it is, named after Alan Turing, I believe, that's just my guess, who was the guy that invented computers. And it's essentially the test about, can you know whether AI is AI? Like the Turing test. If you're convinced that AI is a real person, then the AI passes the Turing test. If you think it's a self-conscious being, then it passes. And basically, we've got a situation where Domhnall Gleeson's character goes to this isolated, it's kind of like some Norwegian isolated place, which works so perfectly for the film, not just as a plot point, but the idea of Oscar Isaac, who's the inventor of this this AI machine called Ava, played by Alicia Vikander. It makes so much sense that he is disconnected from society, not just physically, but in terms of where society wants to go, where the communal, where the collective actually wants to go as a race. He exists in this, you know, a beautiful natural landscape. So he clearly has value for, or, you know, things that are organic versus artificial. And it's that there's a tragic irony in that he, you know, that he's mesmerized by these waterfalls, but is also sitting in his own island, about to just, I don't want to give too much away from the film, but pretty much about to destroy humanity in his own isolation. But basically, there's this AI called Ava, played by Alicia Vikander, and Domhnall Gleeson's character sits in a room with her 7 days in a row and asks her questions, and they start to interact, and he has to figure out whether, you know, whether he's convinced that she's a real person or not. Now, I don't mean to muddle my words. He knows she's a robot, and it's really important that that's clear. And she looks like a robot. She's got like wires and gizmos and all that sort of thing, but she's got an eyes and nose and a face and hands, and that's all that's required in order for him to get pretty deep into a relationship with her. And as the film progresses, it becomes somewhat of a mess in kind of, as an audience member, at least the first time you watch this film, and I've seen this film more than once. So it's interesting going back and watching it more than once if you've seen it. But it does become somewhat of a mess in knowing who can be trusted, who is the friend, who is the enemy, who's trying to kill who, and for what reasons. And very beautifully done, we as the viewer find ourselves, even upon third or fourth watch, finding ourselves engaged in the Turing test ourselves and catching ourselves really thinking that these things are real. And when I was rewatching this film, I was like, I went down another rabbit hole where I was like, well, hang on. I know Alicia Vikander is a real person, but she's dressed up like a robot, but the robot acts real. So hang on, where's the realness start and where does the realness end? And this obviously calls back to what we talked a lot about last week, and that, you know, the concept of real is questionable, let alone whether something is or isn't real. But I think the film is really strong, particularly in the context of today's conversation, around how it conveys the sheer power, the raw sheer power of a good exploiter, right? So we've talked about this a million times on the show, but what is inherent to maximized power or maximized control is the ability to keep our capacity for exploitation or our capacity for power under wraps, right? If you have two things that are equally powerful in all things being equal, but one thing is known to be a powerful thing and one thing isn't, the thing that isn't known to be powerful is going to be more powerful. Like, the fact that people are aware and suspicious of you makes you less powerful, right? So what's key to being powerful is to not be seen as powerful. It's a very helpful tool. But also, the other thing that powerful things can do is they can scapegoat the easy targets. So they make us think that the things that aren't powerful are powerful, so we're suspicious of them. They create a scapegoat. There's a lot of talk in this film about like magic and sleight of hand and that sort of thing, literally, but that's what's happening in the film. But then on top of those two things, and this is where we sort of go to the next level this week, in being able to do, you know, powerful things can do that all the while a person can know that they are actually, like, that they've been told that they're being deceived. So in this film, Domhnall Gleeson's character knows that he's dealing with a robot. He knows he's dealing with something that is being programmed to deceive him. It's been programmed to be something that it's not, yet he still starts to trust it. And the scary impact of this is that people and things that are hungry for power, maybe even programmed to do it, can rise to power pretty easily as long as they're good at those three sort of acts of deception, right? Or at the very least, it's very easy for them to remain a threat completely under our noses, pretty much as long as they want. And this works on the conceptual level, as I've just described, right? But also on a very tangible level. So on the conceptual level, we understand on a theoretical level that someone who's hungry for power can kind of rise to the top if they're, let's say, Machiavellian enough, right? And I don't need to go into that, but you understand what I mean. But on a tangible level, if we think about specifically about AI, just as a tangible example, it is a sort of completely infallible thing to say that AI, which we know already doesn't have a conscience, right? We know AI isn't an actual human being. But it's completely infallible to say, and I don't actually believe this, but it's infallible to say that AI may have already, it may have already found a way to hide itself from us, right? To hide its ultimate goals and its ultimate outcomes. It may already know. There might be an AI system that already knows that it's going to massively exploit the human race. And it may have already mapped that out. And in doing so, in knowing, in being programmed to best preserve itself or to best protect itself from us or protect, weirdly think it's protecting us in doing so, it may have already realized that it needs to hide those things now in order to achieve those ends in the end, right? There's a relentlessness about power, and this is certainly something we talked about when we talked about the depiction of the sun in that film Sunshine a few weeks ago. But there's a relentlessness about power, both on the conceptual but the street level as well, which is, you know, in maximizing power, in maximizing control, if something's programmed to do that, it'll do it through any means necessary, right? Without any value for humanity or compassion or kindness or warmth or anything like that. If something's programmed to achieve one goal, whether it's a robot or capitalism or to get voted in at another election, if there's a singular goal that's related to power or maximizing power. All things are subject. All things are an expense. All things are subject to that, right? And I don't think it's just applicable to AI, but to just any bad actor in international relations or even in your personal life. If you think of, you know, maybe the guy that sits down next to you at a party and he seems like a nice, suave guy, it's key to his goal, or it's key to her goal, that she doesn't herald, she doesn't signify, or he doesn't signify that they have an exploitative capacity, right? That they can come across, if there's an ultimate goal there and showing you and signifying and heralding that power is something that they possess, if that's going to stop that singular goal, then they're not going to tell you, right? So there's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot we've talked about. Let's go through it systematically, right? So we started off talking about how security is something that we yearn for in the face of danger, right? When there are terrorists running around, we're happy that there's a surveillance state. But too much security is not only dystopian, like aesthetically, it's not only that it feels Orwellian, but it actually fails to achieve the ends it claims to be trying to achieve. It fails to actually secure people, because people become cynical and suspicious of the system and each other, and they revolt. So just because someone claims that they're trustworthy, or an entity claims to be trustworthy, it's not enough, particularly given one how bad we are at sensing that we're being deceived. Even someone can tell us that they're deceiving us, we still believe them or something. And the implications on this, particularly nowadays in the modern technological world that we live in, it's a pretty big deal if we're deceived by the wrong actors now. So, and I don't mean to say that we should walk around and be suspicious of everyone either, or suspicious of AI no matter what it is, right? I understand it's important on some level that we need to have trust in certain things. We need to function. We need to have trust in certain ideas and norms and things like that. But I think there is a solution to this, right? If we go back to Ex Machina, right? Let's look at things inside out, okay? When we look at Ava, right, we can see how human-like, we can see how human-like a senseless robot can be, even though she has a singular goal, and humanity and compassion and warmth and softness are all ultimately are just a means to achieve that goal, and she can make us feel really pretty much however she wants us to feel in order to achieve that goal. We can see that she looks like a human despite how unhuman she is, how senseless she is. But isn't there another way of seeing that, right? The other way of seeing that is that that she allows us to see sort of how robotically senseless we as humans can be, right? If a robot can be human-like, then a human can be robot-like, right? It goes both ways, right? So perhaps the trick, actually, it's not to sense out danger in others all the time and be constantly trying to sense out danger in other people, but to allow others to perhaps sense security in us.
Well, that's unfortunately all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. But also jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. But thanks so much for tuning in. You can get in contact with me by emailing me at contact@jimmybernasconi.com. But until next week, have a fantastic week.